Okay, usual caveat. I could be wrong. I'm a human being. I make mistakes. We've got three themes running for the rest of this year on Sunday mornings for the learning program or the teaching program, whatever you want to call it. For some reason, which I'm really not quite sure about, but I must have had something to do with it, the first of each of those themes has happened in the last 3 weeks. So Peter Elliott started off with the first of a series that he's going to do on major changes in the church in the 20th century. Last week, David Cohen kicked off a series we're doing on Psalms, in which a number of people will be asked to pick a psalm and then speak on it. And this week, we're starting a series on James, which we're doing this session is probably not going to be as interactive as most sessions are. The material just doesn't allow that, feel right for that. But if anybody's got something they want to say, please say it. And we will be talking about Luther at some stage. Our Lutheran expert has disappeared. Never mind. You're on the floor? Okay. Well, ready when you are, Claire. All right. Yeah. Okay, if you can't talk about James without talking about Luther, I'll explain that in a bit. So I'm kicking off with an overview today, and that is just an overview. We won't be looking at James in any great depth. We'll be skimming over it and talking about it rather than going into any detail. First of all, a description of the book by one commentator. Trust me, you're going to like this, all right? The least doctrinal and most practical book in the New Testament. If that doesn't make you want to grab it and start browsing, I don't know what would. Certainly makes me feel like that. Possibly bad news for theologians, but who cares about theologians? Who wrote the Epistle of James? Well, fortunately, it's written by somebody who starts off by saying who they are. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. Problem is, there are rather a lot of Jameses in the New Testament. Three in particular. One is James, the brother of John. You remember the two guys who tried to get Jesus to promise them the number one and two seats in the kingdom? James, the son of Alphaeus, was another disciple, but we don't know much about him. And then there's James, the brother of Jesus, or as people like to say, the half-brother of Jesus, pedantic people. And most of the thinking, traditionally, it's that last James, James, the brother of Jesus, who wrote this. James, the brother of Jesus, right through history of the church, there's been arguments over this, though. One of the main arguments against it being James, the brother of Jesus, is the writer of this book uses really sophisticated Greek. He uses Greek really well, sort of academic-style Greek. And therefore people have said, well, hang on, the carpenter's son from Galilee, a little Jewish boy, wouldn't be able to use Greek like that. And other people say, well, late in his life he probably wrote this book, so he may have been able to develop his skills in Greek, and the ones in the previous camp say, rubbish, it can't happen. I sort of tended to agree with that, but then I thought of something. In this church, we have a woman called Bobby Oliver. Some of you will have met her. She's Dr. Bobby Oliver. She's Associate Professor Bobby Oliver. You all know that. What some of you may not know is that she grew up on a farm. A little farm in outback Queensland, and she did her education by correspondence course. The first time she entered a proper school, she was 15 years old. She left when she was 17. Now, I think if historians looked at that later on and said, this Professor Bobby Oliver, who's written these books and had them published and writes the historian stuff and writes so well in such an academic style, can't be that same person because somebody coming from that background wouldn't have had those skills. It can happen. My feeling, and I know as little as anybody does about this, something else about another argument against it being that particular James is that whenever he refers to the Old Testament, he uses what is called a quotation from the Septuagint, which is a Greek version of the Old Testament. And the argument is that if he was a good Jewish boy, he would use the Hebrew version. But then the other people in the other camp say, no, he would have used the Greek version because that's the version that most people would be familiar with, and he's not just talking to a Jewish audience. So the arguments go on, and PhDs get written, and conferences get held, and the answer is, who wrote James? We don't know. I've got a suspicion And it is only a suspicion. If you wanted me to back him, I would say it's James, the brother of Jesus, simply because he is described in very strong terms by various people as somebody who was a really good person, a really righteous person, and whoever wrote this book was a really righteous person, someone who loved God and wanted to serve them. Who was it written to? To the 12 tribes in the dispersion. Greetings. That's helpful. Sounds like an Old Testament Jewish thing. Diaspora, the word, is used to refer to Jewish communities which are outside Palestine, but this word is also used on more than one occasion to refer to the scattered churches, Christian churches. It's used exactly the same phrase is used at the beginning of the Epistle of Peter, when again he's talking about the Christian churches. It's clear that the letter is written to a wide audience. Paul, when he wrote a letter, tended to write to a specific church and address the specific problems within that specific church. But this letter is clearly written to all and sundry, if you like. It's been described as a manual of Christian conduct that assumes a foundation of faith, and you can see that in the book. He's writing to Christians. He's writing to Christians who are already part of churches, so he's not writing to non-Christians. He's not writing to new Christians. He's writing to Christians who have an established way of doing things, much the way we are. You know, we meet, we do various things. We even James specifically talks about teachers and elders within the communities. So he's talking to a group of Christians who are Christians broadly, very much like we are. Before going on to talk about the letter in a bit more detail, I want to clarify a couple of things that are widely known about the Epistle of James. And they come from a well-known troublemaker, Martin Luther. What did Martin Luther say about James? Somebody tell me.
A right strawy epistle.
A right strawy epistle, yes. Anyone else heard that phrase? An epistle of straw? No? That's what Luther said about this. Luther said it's an epistle of straw. But, Jen? Kick it out of the Bible. He had doubts about it. Yes, he definitely did have doubts about it. The interesting thing about the quote about the epistle of straw is he wrote a translation of the New Testament, and this phrase came up in his preface. He was someone who had a bit of a temper. He could get angry in a hurry and did things which, you know, probably weren't very wise, and he managed to do them in writing. I don't know how that you can actually get angry in those days and actually write something in haste and then regret it later. I mean, goodness knows what his emails would have looked like.
Twitter.
Hey? Yeah. His Twitter. But the interesting thing is he put that in the preface in the very first edition of the New Testament that he translated in 1522, and then in all subsequent editions he got rid of it, and it was him who got rid of it. It wasn't anyone else. He took out the whole paragraph, which raised questions about the authenticity of a number of books, and he took out that whole paragraph. So he put it there, but he changed his mind. Nonetheless, we tend to remember him for saying that. The second thing that Luther is remembered for saying about James is that you can't... Sorry. Oh, yeah, okay, this is something Luther said about James later on. So balance that up against the Epistle of Straw. It's a good book because it sets up no doctrine of men, but vigorously promulgates the law of God. And he's absolutely right, it does. Yes. So Luther wasn't as anti-James as you might think so from just the Epistle of Straw thing. He also said you cannot reconcile the teachings of James with the teachings of Paul. He said something lovely. I like this. Hang on, where was it? Luther remarked that he would give his doctor's beret to anyone who could reconcile James and Paul. You know, when you become some of you here have become doctors, I know, they give you a special hat. At different levels of degrees they do. When you become a doctor, you wear a particular hat. So in Luther's day, they probably wear them more often than academics tend to today. But you go to an academic function of some kind and you could tell who was important by the kind of hat they were wearing. And the beret that the PhDs wore, the doctors, the top... people specified them in a crowd so you'd know what how low to bow or what kind of obeisance you should pay to them. And I just love that. He's going to give his doctor's beret to anyone who can reconcile James and Paul. This is about the famous faith versus works problem. James talks a lot about works, meaning it's what you do that's important, And the argument was, well, Paul says it's faith that's important, and can these two be reconciled? Luther actually, later on, reconciled them about as well as anybody could, I think. Hello? Just hang on a second. He said, faith is a living, restless thing. It cannot be inoperative. We are not saved by works, but if there be no works, there must be something amiss with faith. You get that? Incidentally, I know I've said this before, but the word which is translated faith in Greek, or belief, the word pistis, which I like because it sounds slightly rude, can also be translated trust. Now, for me, I think it's always worthwhile, when you come across this word, translating it as trust, first of all, because it's something that's going on in the heart, not in the head. If you talk about faith or belief, it tends to be something which is, you know, intellectual, saying, yes, I believe this, I believe this. But if you use the word trust instead, try that and see how it goes. This isn't a quote from the Bible, this is Luther. But if it said, trusting God is a living, restless thing, it cannot be inoperative, we are not saved by works, but if there be no works, there must be something amiss with our trusting God. It makes some sense. Enough of Luther. I'm going to do something I've never done before in this church. Are you ready? Oh, yeah. Let me explain this, and if you don't like it, I loved it. You know, David Cohen introduced me to this. He does this in lectures at Vaux, so they're good, aren't they? Yeah. What this is a Wordle. You can find Wordle just by putting W-O-R-D-L-E into Google, and it'll take you so you'll find the Wordle page quite quickly. And what Wordle does, it's just a piece of software. You can put in any block of text that you like, and it will count the number of times words come up, and then it will give you this representation, and the bigger the word is on this, the more times it's come up in the document. So you can do that with any block of text, and I copied and pasted the whole of James into Wordle, and without any problems at all. Well, I did have to get Nick to come and help me a couple of times. Eventually, without any problems at all, it came up with this. And I asked it to specify the 50 most common words, so you're not getting all the words in James here, just the 50 most common words. It's a way of looking at it and thinking, what's this book about? Zap. There's a bit of an answer here, which is a slightly different representation. This word one right at the bottom, that's because of the actual version of the Bible that I was using. I was using the NRSV, and it says things like the one who said, referring to God, or one, or a person, meaning a person. It will say one will do this, one will do that. So the word one crops up an awful lot in this particular translation. It's not actually theologically significant. But you can see the other big words there are God, Lord, faith, works, brothers, sisters. Brothers and sisters are the same size, because these days the NRSV, whenever it comes across the word brothers, which is in the Greek, translates it as brothers and sisters. We could spend the rest of the day arguing that one, but we're not going to. Law is very big there, you see. Right, I just thought that might be interesting. I'll move on. God, Lord, faith, works are the ones we see in large letters there. I don't know whether you've ever noticed this, but I've got this thing about the teachings of Jesus. Yes, you have. Okay. We believe that Jesus is God. We believe he always was, always will be. We believe that his teachings are the teachings of God. Jesus said, all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. He said, you have one teacher, and that is the Christ. So Jesus is really, really important. That's why we're called Christians. James almost doesn't mention him at all. You remember that introduction thing? He described himself as a servant of Jesus Christ. One other point, and only one other point in the book, he talks to the people he's talking to. He said, are you really servants of Jesus? And the rest of the time, he doesn't mention him at all. So that's two times. In Paul's epistle to the Romans, he refers to Jesus 36 times. And I know, I counted them yesterday. No, I didn't go through it one by one. I've got software that brings up every time that Paul talked about Jesus, and I just had to read the size of the column. So you get the feeling that James isn't actually talking about Jesus very much. This gets really interesting, at least I think it's really interesting. James is not a book about Jesus. James is not a book that reflects directly on the teachings of Jesus. Never actually quotes Jesus. And it reads like a book of wisdom. It is a book of wisdom. It sounds like a whole lot of interesting sayings. It's a bit like the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament. And it also sounds like blocks of Jesus' teachings, like the Sermon on the Mount. You know, the Sermon on the Mount. It sounds like when Jesus was talking. The way James speaks sounds very much like that. So it's a book of practical wisdom. It's a collection of wise sayings, but it is Christian wisdom. It actually really sounds like Jesus talking. In fact, sometimes it sounds as though James is paraphrasing or quoting Jesus. Let me give you three examples. James 5:12, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Jesus said, do not swear at all either by heaven or by the earth or by Jerusalem. Do not swear by your head. You cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes or no, no. Sounds similar? Very, yeah. James says, has not God chosen the poor in the world to be rich in faith and to be heirs of the kingdom that he has promised to those who love him? And Jesus says, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. James says, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. And Jesus says, all who exalt themselves will be humbled and all who humble themselves will be exalted. And just on a personal note, there's been a number of occasions when I've this particular verses stick in your heads, you know, the ones that are important to you. And there have been a number of occasions when I've said, oh yes, Jesus said that, and it turned out that I was wrong. It's actually James who said it, and here's an example. If any of you is lacking in wisdom, ask God, who gives to all generously and ungrudgingly, and it will be given you. That familiar? It's I think it's an extraordinary verse. It does sound to me as though Jesus said it. It always does, but apparently Jesus didn't say this. James said it, and it's true. You know, if we're asking for something like wisdom, and we really pray for it, and we really want it, it's going to happen. I think I probably told you what happened when I prayed for humility once. Yeah, yes, yeah, very horrible experience. But if God, if you're asking for something like wisdom, if you're asking for something like humility, if you're asking to God to enable you to love your neighbour more or to love him more, the answer is going to be yes. God is going to meet that prayer. If that's what you're really pleading with him for, it's going to be yes. The trouble is, he's not just going to snap his fingers, wave a magic wand, and suddenly you're going to be a different person. What he's going to do is to put you through some experiences. And you're going to have to listen to the words of other people and listen to what God says in Scripture and in other places. And over the time, you'll look back and you will say, yes, I did change. Don't start thinking that, oh, yes, I really am wiser than I was, because that means you need to start praying for humility again. But, you know, this works. It really does work. I've finished. Hang on, let me summarise. Who wrote James? James did. That's about all we know. Who was James writing to? He was writing to Christians who have a foundation of faith. So for people like us, it's a really interesting and good book to read. It's a book of practical wisdom. It's a manual of Christian conduct. And as Luther said, if you trust God, it will show in the things you do. Right. Any comments, thoughts? Luke. Sorry, can we use that?
I was just interested to know when it was written. At what point in the history of the church did James write
that? Well, there's arguments about that as well. Most of them put it in around the early 60s AD. So James, if he was the brother of Jesus, would have been probably in his late 50s or around the 60 mark at that time, depending where in the order of kids he came. Yeah. So it's before the sack of Jerusalem, before the dispersal of the Jews. So Yeah. But that's what they say, but nobody really knows. Yeah. Sorry, John. Well, I can only give you a personal response. If I ever had to do it, and it's only come close to it once, I wouldn't do it. I'd do what they call, is it the Quaker's promise?
Well, it's called an affirmation, I think.
Yeah.
When I joined CSIRO, I had to swear, I was asked to swear an oath of allegiance, and it was administered by a high official in CSIRO.
Yeah.
And I said I would affirm, and he said to me, "What? You a communist?"
Yeah.
And to which I didn't reply because I knew I had a right to make an affirmation, which I did, and have always done. Yeah. But I was influenced by the Society of Friends, I must admit.
Yeah. No, I have had to. When I became an Australian citizen, I had to make the choice as to whether I was going to swear or make the affirmation, and I made the affirmation. Yeah.
Does that not? Paul? Just further into general conversation.
Yes.
Stand for what you say.
Yeah.
Don't say, yes. This is right because so and so, in the power vested in me, blah blah blah. This is so, without adding third party reference. Speaking in the name of God and blowing people up in the name of God.
Yeah. We know, you get to know people and you get to know whether they're trustworthy people, whether what they say is likely to be the truth. You just get to know that. That's what this is talking about. We should be like that. Trish?
Just getting back to the bit about faith versus works, Paul versus James, I know that Paul does go on a lot about the importance of faith for salvation, but I've been reading his letters lately and been quite struck by how much he says, in effect, your faith then leads to certain behaviour of a certain standard that pleases God and brings honour to God in the eyes of other people. So I think he's saying the same thing, just the other way around.
Yep.
So when I look at James, I think, well, I suspect what was going on, there were Christians who were misbehaving because they were saying, our faith will get us through, so we don't have to behave, and he's saying, that's not the way it works. You're not being genuine Christians if that's how you're behaving.
Yeah. Ken?
And maybe a way of saying that might be, faith can produce works, but works don't necessarily produce faith, is it?
Yes, I think so.
Possible?
I mean, for me, the whole thing comes down actually to motive.
Sorry.
Ow. Yeah. I thought you had hold of it. No, I thought you had hold of it. Yeah. We know that when God looks at us, he looks at our heart. And I think that's reasonable to say that he's more interested in why we do something than in what we do. If you go back to the sheep and the goats, the famous sheep and the goats, giving a cup of cold water, Jesus said to one of these, you will not lose your reward. Does that mean that if we give a cup of cold water to somebody, then we're definitely going to heaven? I would suggest not. It's why you do it. What's going on in your heart that makes you think, I care about this person, I'm going to help them, rather than just going through the mechanics of, yes, I'd better do that, otherwise I might burn forever. We won't go there. Yeah. All done? Paul?
I would suggest that I don't think you should take that point too far. I think there is a legitimate approach to, I don't think God is as concerned about motives as what people say he is. Sometimes the works are important in their own right, and I think of when Paul was asked by people about, what's his face, who was preaching in God's name, and that people were saying, oh, he's got bad motivations, and Paul said, well, but if good stuff is done, then that stuff is valuable in its own right. It doesn't get that guy any better in God's books, but the works that he's doing is good in their own right. So I wouldn't take that point too far. And the other thing too is that if you are trying to inculcate integrity internally, Scott Peck used to say, fake it to make it. That if you fake it to make it. In other words, if you want to take on board a certain belief system or set of ethics, one of the ways that you do that is by practicing that behaviour. And then by so practicing that behaviour, after some time, it becomes part of who you are. So that is a legitimate way of taking on faith, is by practicing the very thing that you want to emulate.
Do it anyway.
Do it anyway.
Yeah. Gail?
I just had a thought about why James might not have talked a lot about Jesus. I was thinking if my sister was very famous, I would feel like if I kept using her name, I would be big noting myself.
Yeah.
And so instead of that familiarity with God through Jesus, I could understand that James might be referring to God as God and Lord and not continually using Jesus.
Yep.
And so that made sense to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry?
What Gail's saying, that identifies the writer of my books.
Yeah. Identifies him as the brother of Jesus. More likely to, he's more likely to have done that. Okay, all done. Back to Luke.